and the whisky tastes a good bit better going down than yon filthy black stuff." He nodded at my reticule, then at Jared. "Come on, then, if you mean to help me with him."
In the forward cabin of the Porsche, I had sat on the captain's bunk, watching the steady rise and fall of the receding shoreline, my husband's head cradled on my knees. One eye opened a slit and looked up at me. I stroked the heavy, damp hair off his brow. The scent of ale and whiskey hung about him like perfume.
"You are going to feel exactly like hell when you wake up in Scotland," I told him.
The other eye opened and regarded the dancing waves of light reflected across the timbered ceiling. Then they fixed on me, deep pools of limpid blue.
"Between hell now and hell later, Sassenach," he said, his speech measured and precise, "I will take later every time."
His eyes closed. He belched softly once, and the long body relaxed, rocked at ease on the cradle of the deep. The horses seemed eager as we, sensing the nearness of stables and food. They began to push the pace a bit, heads up and ears cocked forward in anticipation. I was just reflecting that I could do with a wash and a bite to eat myself, when my horse, slightly in the lead, dug in its feet and came to a slithering halt, hooves buried fetlock deep in the reddish dust. The mare shook her head violently from side to side, snorting and whooshing.
"Hey, lass, what's amiss? Got a bee up your nose?"
Jamie swung down from his own mount and hurried to grab the grey mare's bridle. Feeling the broad back shiver and twitch beneath me, I slid down as well. "Whatever is the matter with her?" I gazed curiously at the horse, which was pulling backward against Jamie's grip on the bridle, shaking her mane with eyes bugging. The other horses, as though infected by her unease, began to stamp and shift as well. Jamie glanced briefly over his shoulder at the empty road.
"She sees something."
Fergus raised himself in his shortened stirrups and shaded his eyes, staring over the mare's back. Lowering his hand, he looked at me and shrugged. I shrugged back. There seemed to be nothing whatever to cause the mare's distress. The road and the fields lay vacant all around us, grain heads ripening and drying in the late summer sun. The nearest grove of trees was more than 100 yards away, beyond a small heap of stones that might have been the remnants of a tumbled chimney stack. Wolves were almost unheard of in cleared land like this, and surely no fox or badger would disturb a horse at this distance. Giving up the attempt to coax the mare forward, Jamie led her in a half circle. She went willingly enough, back in the direction we had come. He motioned to Murtaugh to lead the other horses out of the way, then swung himself into the saddle, and, leaning forward, one hand clutched in the mare's mane, urged her slowly forward, speaking softly in her ear. She came hesitantly, but without resistance, until she reached the point of her previous stopping. There she halted again, and stood shivering, and nothing would persuade her to move a step farther.
"All right, then," said Jamie, resigned. "Have it your way."
He turned the horse's head and led her into the field, the yellow grain heads brushing the shaggy hairs of her belly. We rustled after them, the horses bending their necks to snatch a mouthful of grain here and there as we passed through the field. As we rounded a small granite outcrop just below the crest of the hill, I heard a brief warning bark just ahead. We emerged onto the road to find a black-and-white shepherd dog on guard, head up and tail stiff as he kept a wary eye on us. He added another short yap, and a matching black-and-white figure shot out of a clump of alders, followed more slowly by a tall, slender figure wrapped in a brown hunting plaid.
"Ian!
Jamie!" Jamie tossed the mare's reins back to me, and met his brother-in-law in the middle of the road, where the two men clutched each other round the shoulders, laughing and pounding each other on the back. Released from suspicion, the dogs frolicked happily around them, tails wagging, darting aside now and then to sniff at the legs of the horses. We didn't expect you till tomorrow at the earliest, Ian was saying, his long, homely face beaming.
We had a good wind crossing, Jamie explained. Or at least Claire tells me we did. I wasn't taking much notice myself.
He cast a glance back at me, grinning, and Ian came up to grasp my hand.
Good sister, he said, informal greeting.
Then he smiled, the warmth of it lighting his soft brown eyes. Claire. Impulsively, he kissed my fingers, and I squeezed his hand.
Jenny's gone daft with cleaning and cooking, he said, still smiling at me. You'll be lucky to have a bed to sleep in tonight. She's got all the mattresses outside being beaten.
After 3 nights in the heather, I wouldn't mind sleeping on the floor, I assured him. Are Jenny and the children all well?
Oh, aye. She's breeding again, he added. Due in February.
Again? Jamie and I spoke together, and a rich blush rose in Ian's lean cheeks.
Good man. Wee Maggie's less than a year old, Jamie said, with a censorious cock of one brow. Have you no sense of restraint?
Me? Ian said indignantly. You think I had anything to do with it?
Well, if you didn't, I should think you'd be interested in who did, Jamie said, the corner of his mouth twitching.
The blush deepened to a rich rose colour, contrasting nicely with Ian's smooth brown hair.
You know damn well what I mean, he said. I slept on the trundle bed with young Jamie for 2 months, but then Jenny... Oh, you're saying my sister's a wanton, eh? I'm saying she's as stubborn as her brother when it comes to getting what she wants, Ian said.
He feinted to one side, dodged neatly back, and landed a blow in the pit of Jamie's stomach. Jamie doubled over, laughing.
Just as well I've come home, then, he said. I'll help you keep her under control. Oh, aye, Ian said sceptically. I'll call all the tenants to watch.
Lost a few sheep, have you?
Jamie changed the subject with a gesture that took in the dogs and Ian's long crook dropped in the dust of the roadway.
15 ewes and a ram, Ian said, nodding. Jenny's own flock of merinos that she keeps for the special wool. The ram's a right bastard. Broke down the gate. I thought they might have been in the grain up here, but nae sign of them.
We didn't see them up above, I said.
Oh, they wouldn't be up there, Ian said,
waving a dismissive hand.
None of the beasts will go past the cottage.
Cottage?
Fergus, growing impatient with his exchange of civilities, had kicked his mount up alongside mine.
I saw no cottage, milor. Only a pile of stones.
That's all that's left of McNab's cottage, laddie, said Ian.
He squinted up at Fergus, silhouetted against the late afternoon sun.
And you'd be well advised to keep away from there yourself.
The hair prickled on the back of my neck, despite the heat of the day. Ronald McNab was the tenant who had betrayed Jamie to the men of the watch a year before. The man who had died for his treachery within a day of its being found out. Died, I remembered, among the ashes of his home, burned over his head by the men of Lallybroch. The pile of chimney stones, so innocent when we had passed them a moment ago, had now the grim look of a cairn. I swallowed, forcing back the bitter taste that rose at the back of my throat.
McNab, Jamie said softly.
His expression was at once alert.
Ronnie McNab.
I had told Jamie of McNab's betrayal and his death, but I hadn't told him the means of it. Ian nodded.
Aye. He died there, the night the English took you, Jamie. The thatch must have caught from a spark, and him too far gone in drink to get out in time.
He met Jamie's eyes straight on, all teasing gone.
Ah. And his wife and child.
Jamie's look was the same as Ian's, cool and inscrutable.
Safe. Mary McNab's kitchen-maid at the house and Rabbi works in the stables.
Ian glanced involuntarily over his shoulder in the direction of the ruined cottage.
Mary comes up here now and again. She's the only one on the place we'll go there. Was she fond of him, then?
Jamie had turned to look in the direction of the cottage, so his face was hidden from me, but there was tension in the line of his back. Ian shrugged.
I shouldn't think so. A drunkard, and vicious with it, was Ronnie. Not even his old mother had much use for him. No, I think Mary feels it her duty to pray for his soul. Much good it'll do him, he added. Ah.
Jamie paused a moment as though in thought, then tossed his horse's reins over its neck and turned up the hill.
Jamie, I said. But he was already walking back up the road toward the small clearing beside the grove. I handed the reins I was holding to a surprised Fergus. "Stay here with the horses," I said. "I have to go with him."
Ian moved to come with me, but Murtaugh stopped him with a shake of the head, and I went on alone, following Jamie up over the crest of the hill. He had the long, tireless stride of a hill-walker, and had reached the small clearing before I caught him up. He stood at the edge of what had been the outer wall. The square shape of the cottage's earth floor was still barely visible, the new growth that covered it, sparser than the nearby barley, greener and wild in the shade of the trees. There was little trace of the fire left. A few chunks of charred wood poked through the grass near the stone hearth that lay open now, flat and exposed as a tombstone. Careful not to step within the outlines of the vanished walls, Jamie began to walk around the clearing. He circled the hearthstone three times, walking always widdershins, left and left and left again, to confound any evil that might follow. I stood to one side and watched. This was a private confrontation, but I couldn't leave him to face it alone. And though he didn't glance at me, still I knew he was glad of my presence. At last he stopped by the fallen pile of stones. Reaching out, he laid a hand gingerly on it and closed his eyes for a moment as though in prayer. Then, stooping, he picked up a stone the size of his fist and placed it carefully on the pile, as though it might weigh down the uneasy soul of the ghost. He crossed himself, turned, and came toward me with a firm, unhurried step.
"Don't look back," he said quietly,
taking me by the arm as we turned toward the road. I didn't. Jamie, Fergus and Murtaugh went with Ian and the dogs in search of the sheep, leaving me to take the string of horses down to the house alone. I was far from being an accomplished horse handler, but thought I could manage half a mile, so long as nothing popped out at me unexpectedly. This was very different from our first homecoming to Lallybroch. Then we had been in flight, both of us. Me from the future, Jamie from his past. Our residence then had been happy, but tenuous and insecure. There was always a chance of discovery, of Jamie's arrest. Now, thanks to the Duke of Sandringham's intervention, Jamie had come to take possession of his birthright, and I, my lawful place beside him as his wife. Then we had arrived dishevelled, unexpected, a violent disruption in the household. This time we had come announced, with due ceremony, bearing presents from France. While I was sure our reception would be cordial, I did wonder how Ian and Jamie's sister Jenny would take our permanent return. After all, they had lived as master and mistress of the estate for the last several years, ever since the death of Jamie's father, and the disastrous events that had precipitated him into a life of outlawry and exile. I topped the last hill without incident, and the manor house and its outbuildings lay below me, slate roofs darkening as the first banks of rain clouds rolled in. Suddenly, my mare started, and so did I, struggling to keep a hold on the reins as she curvetted and plunged in alarm. Not that I could blame her. From around the corner of the house had emerged two huge puffy objects, rolling along the ground like overweight clouds. "Stop that," I shouted. "Whoa!" All the horses were now swerving and pulling, and I was inches away from a stampede. Fine homecoming, I thought,
if I let all Jamie's new breeding stock break their collective legs. One of the clouds rose slightly, then sank flat to the ground, and Jenny Fraser Murray, released from the burden of the feather mattress she had been carrying, raced for the road, dark curls flying. Without a moment's hesitation, she leapt for the bridle of the nearest animal and jerked down hard.
"Whoa!" she said.
The horse, obviously recognising the voice of authority, did whoa. With a little effort, the other horses were calmed, and by the time I could slide down from my saddle, we had been joined by another woman and a boy of 9 or 10 who lent an experienced hand with the remaining beasts. I recognised young Rabbi McNab, and deduced that the woman must be his mother, Mary. The bustle and shuffle of horses, bundles and mattresses precluded much conversation, but I had time for a quick hug of greeting with Jenny. She smelled of cinnamon and honey and the clean sweat of exertion, with an undertone of baby scent, that paradoxical smell composed of spit-up milk, soft feces, and the ultimate cleanliness of fresh, smooth skin. We clung together for a moment, hugging tight, remembering our last embrace when we had parted on the edge of a night-dark wood, me to go in search of Jamie, she to return to a newborn daughter.
"How's little Maggie?" I asked, breaking away at last.
Jenny made a face, wryness mingled with pride.
"She's just walking, and the terror of the house."
She glanced up the empty road.
"Met Ian, did you?"
"Yes. Jamie, Murtaugh and Fergus went with him to find the sheep."
"Better them than us," she said, with a quick gesture toward the sky. "It's coming on to rain any minute. Let Rabbi stable the horses, and you come lend a hand with the mattresses, or we'll all sleep wet tonight."
A frenzy of activity ensued, but when the rain came, Jenny and I were snug in the parlour, admiring the size and precocity of wee Maggie, a sprightly miss of some 10 months, with round blue eyes and a head of strawberry fuzz, and her elder brother, young Jamie, a sturdy, almost 4-year-old. The impending arrival was no more than a tiny bulge beneath their mother's apron, but I saw her hand rest tenderly there from time to time, and felt a small pang to see it.
"You mentioned Fergus," Jenny said as we talked. "Who's that?" "Oh, Fergus. He's...
I hesitated, not sure quite how to describe Fergus. A pickpocket's prospects for employment on a farm seemed limited.
"He's Jamie's," I said at last. "Oh, aye. Well, I suppose he can sleep in the stable," said Jenny, resigned. "Speaking of Jamie..."
She glanced at the window where the rain was streaming down.
"I hope they find those sheep soon. I've a good dinner planned, and a dinner wanted to spoil with keeping."
In fact, darkness had fallen, and Mary McNab had laid the table before the men returned. I watched her at work, a small, fine-boned woman with dark brown hair, and a faintly worried look that faded into a smile when Rabbi returned from the stables and went into the kitchen, hungrily asking when dinner would be.
"When the men are back, Mulua," she said, "you know that. Go and wash so you will be ready."
When the men did finally appear, they seemed a good deal more in need of a wash than did Rabbi. Rain-soaked, draggled, and muddy to the knees, they trailed slowly into the parlour. Ian unwound the wet plaid from his shoulders and hung it over the fire-screen, where it dripped and steamed in the heat of the fire. Fergus, worn out by his abrupt introduction to farm life, simply sat down where he was and stared numbly at the floor between his legs. Jenny looked up at the brother she hadn't seen for nearly a year. Glancing from his rain-drenched hair to his mud-crusted feet, she pointed to the door.
"Outside, and off with your boots," she said firmly. "And if you've been in the high field, remember to piss on the doorposts on your way back in." "That's how you keep a ghost from coming in the house," she explained to me in a lowered tone, with a quick look at the door through which Mary McNab had disappeared to fetch the dinner.
Jamie slumped into a chair,
opened one eye and gave his sister a dark blue look.
I land in Scotland near dead wi' the crossing, ride for 4 days over the hills to get here, and when I arrive, I can't even come in the house for a drop to wet my parched throat. Instead, I'm off through the mud, hunting lost sheep, and once I do get here, you want to send me out in the dark again to piss on doorposts. Oh.
He closed the eye again, crossed his hands across his stomach, and sank lower in his chair, a study in stubborn negation.
"Jamie, my dearie," his sister said sweetly, "do you want your dinner, or shall I feed it to the dogs?"
He remained motionless for a long moment, eyes closed. Then, with a hissing sigh of resignation, he got laboriously to his feet. With a moody twitch of his shoulder, he summoned Ian, and the two of them turned, following Murtaugh, who was already out the door. As he passed, Jamie reached down a long arm, hauled Fergus to his feet, and dragged the boy sleepily along.
"Welcome home," Jamie said morosely,
and with a last wistful glance at fire and whiskey, trudged out into the night once more. Chapter 31 Mail Call. After this inauspicious homecoming, matters rapidly improved. Lallybroch absorbed Jamie at once, as though he'd never left, and I found myself pulled effortlessly into the current of farm life as well. It was an unsettled autumn with frequent rain, but with fair, bright days that made the blood sing, too. The place bustled with life, everyone hurrying through the harvest time and the preparations that must be made for the coming winter. Lallybroch was remote, even for a Highland farm. No real roads led there, but the post still reached us by messenger, over the crags and the heather-clad slopes, a connection with the world outside. It was a world that sometimes seemed unreal in memory, as though I had never danced among the mirrors of Versailles. But the letters brought back France, and reading them, I could see the poplar trees along the Rue Trémoulin, or hear the reverberating bong of the cathedral bell that hung above l'Hôpital des Anges. Louise's child was born safely, a son. Her letters, rife with exclamations and underlinings, overflowed with besotted descriptions of the angelic Henri. Of his father, putative or real, there was no mention. Charles Stuart's letter, arriving a month later, made no mention of the child, but according to Jamie, was even more incoherent than usual, seething with vague plans and grandiosities. The Earl of Mar wrote soberly and circumspectly, but his general annoyance with Charles was clear. The bonny prince was not behaving. He was rude and overbearing to his most loyal followers, ignored those who might be of help to him, insulted whom he should not, talked wildly, and, reading between the lines, drank to excess. Given the attitude of the times regarding alcoholic intake on the part of gentlemen, I thought Charles's performance must have been fairly spectacular to occasion such comment. I suppose the birth of his son had not, in fact, escaped his notice. Mother Hildegard wrote from time to time, brief informative notes squeezed into a few minutes that could be snatched from her daily schedule. Each letter ended with the same words. Bouton also sends his regards. Master Raymond did not write, but every so often a parcel would come addressed to me, unsigned and unmarked, but containing odd things, rare herbs and small faceted crystals, a collection of stones, each the size of Jamie's thumbnail, smooth and disc-shaped. Each one had a tiny figure carved into one side, some with lettering above or on the reverse. And then there were the bones, a bear's digit, with the great curved claw still attached. The complete vertebrae of a small snake, articulated and strung on a leather thong, so the whole string flexed in a lifelike manner. An assortment of teeth, ranging from a string of round peg-like things that Jamie said came from a seal, through the high-crowned scythe-cusped teeth of deer, to something that looked suspiciously like a human molar. From time to time I carried some of the smooth, carved stones in my pocket, enjoying the feel of them between my fingers. They were old, I knew that much, from Roman times at least, perhaps even earlier. And from the look of some of the creatures on them, whoever had carved them had meant them to be magic. Whether they were like herbs, having some actual virtue, or only a symbol, like the signs of the Kabbalah, I didn't know. They seemed benign, though, and I kept them. While I enjoyed the daily round of domestic tasks, what I liked best were the long walks to the various cottages on the estate. I always carried a large basket with me on these visits, containing an assortment of things, from small treats for the children to the most commonly needed medicines. These were called for frequently, for poverty and poor hygiene made illness common, and there were no physicians north of Fort William or south of Inverness. Some ailments I could treat readily, like the bleeding gums and skin eruptions, characteristic of mild scurvy. Other things were beyond my power to heal. I laid a hand on Rabbi McNab's head. The shaggy hair was damp at his temples, but his jaw hung open, slack, relaxed, and the pulse in his neck beat slowly. "He's all right now," I said. His mother could see that as well as I could. He lay sprawled in the peaceful abandon of sleep, cheeks flushed from the heat of the nearby fire. Still, she stayed tense and watchful, hovering over the bedstead until I spoke. Once I had given absolution to the evidence of her own eyes, she was willing to believe, though. Her bunched shoulders slumped under her shawl. "Thank the Blessed Mother," Mary McNab murmured, crossing herself briefly. "And thank you, my lady." "I didn't do anything," I protested. This was quite literally true. The only service I'd been able to render young Rabbi was to make his mother let him alone. It had, in fact, taken a certain amount of forcefulness to discourage her efforts to feed him bran mixed with cock's blood, wave burning feathers under his nose, or dash cold water over him. None of these remedies being of marked use to someone suffering an epileptic seizure. When I arrived, his mother had been volubly regretting her inability to administer the most effective of remedies, spring water drunk from the skull of a suicide.
"It frights me so when he's teen like that," Mary McNab said, gazing longingly at the bed where her son lay. "I had Father McMurtry to him the last time, and he prayed a terrible long time and sprinkled holy water on the lad to drive the devils out. But now they've come back."
She clasped her hands tight together, as though she wished to touch her son but couldn't bring herself to do so.
"It isn't devils," I said. "It's only a sickness, and not all that bad a one at that." "Aye, my lady, and you say so," she murmured, unwilling to contradict me, but plainly unconvinced. "He'll be all right," I tried to reassure the woman without raising hopes that couldn't be met. "He always recovers from these fits, doesn't he?" The fits had come on 2 years ago, probably the result of head injury from beatings administered by his late father, I thought. And while the seizures were infrequent, they were undeniably terrifying to his mother when they occurred. She nodded reluctantly, plainly unconvinced.
"Aye, though he bangs his head something fearful now and then, thrashing as he does."
"Yes, that's a risk," I said patiently. "If he does it again, just pull him away from anything hard and let him alone. I know it looks bad, but really he'll be quite all right. Just let the fit run its course, and when it's over, put him to bed and let him sleep." I knew that words were of limited value, no matter how true they might be. Something more concrete was needed for reassurance. As I turned to go, I heard a small click in the deep pocket of my skirt, and had a sudden inspiration. Reaching in, I pulled out two or three of the small, smooth charm stones Raymond had sent me. I selected the milky white one, chalcedony, perhaps, with the tiny figure of a writhing man carved into one side. "So that's what it's for," I thought.
"Sew this into his pocket," I said, laying the tiny charm ceremoniously in the woman's hand. "It will protect him from devils." I cleared my throat. "You needn't worry about him, then, even if he has another fit. He'll come out of it all right." I left then, feeling at once extremely foolish and halfway pleased, amidst an eager flood of relieved thanks. I wasn't sure whether I was becoming a better physician or merely a more practiced charlatan. Still, if I couldn't do much for Rabbi, I could help his mother, or let her help herself at least. Healing comes from the healed, not from the physician. That much Raymond had taught me. I left the house then to do my errands for the day, calling on two of the cottages near the west end of the farm. All was well at the Kirby's and the Western Frasers, and I was soon on my way back to the house. At the top of a slope, I sat down under a large beech tree to rest for a moment before the long walk back. The sun was coming down the sky, but hadn't yet reached the row of pines that topped the ridge on the west side of Lallybroch. It was still late afternoon, and the world glowed with the colours of late autumn. The fallen beech mast was cool and slippery under me, but a good many leaves still clung, yellowed and curling, to the tree above. I leaned back against the smooth-barked trunk and closed my eyes, dimming the bright glare of ripe barley fields to a dark red glow behind my eyelids. The stifling confines of the crofters' cottages had given me a headache. I leaned my head against the birch's smooth bark and began to breathe slowly and deeply, letting the fresh outdoor air fill my lungs, beginning what I always thought of as turning in. This was my own imperfect attempt to duplicate the feeling of the process Master Raymond had shown me in L'Hôpital des Anges. A summoning of the look and feel of each bit of myself, imagining exactly what the various organs and systems looked and felt like when they were functioning properly. I sat quietly, hands loose in my lap, and listened to the beat of my heart. Beating fast from the exertion of the climb, it slowed quickly to a resting pace. The autumn breeze lifted the tendrils of hair from my neck and cooled my fire-flushed cheeks. I sat, eyes closed, and traced the path of my blood from the secret thick-walled chambers of my heart, blue-purple through the pulmonary artery, reddening swiftly as the sacs of the lungs dumped their burden of oxygen, then out in a bursting surge through the arch of the aorta and the tumbling race upward and down and out through carotids, renals, subclavians. To the smallest capillaries, blooming beneath the surface of the skin, I traced the path of my blood through the systems of my body, remembering the feel of perfection, of health, of peace. I sat still, breathing slowly, feeling languorous and heavy as though I had just risen from the act of love. My skin felt thin, my lips slightly swollen, and the pressure of my clothes was like the touch of Jamie's hands. It was no random choice that had invoked his name to cure me. Whether it was health of mind or body, the love of him was necessary to me as breath or blood. My mind reached out for him, sleeping or waking, and finding him was satisfied. My body flushed and glowed, and as it came to full life, it hungered for his. The headache was gone. I sat a moment longer, breathing. Then I got to my feet and walked down the hill toward home. I had never actually had a home. Orphaned at 5, I had lived the life of an academic vagabond with my Uncle Lamb for the next 13 years, in tents on a dusty plain, in caves in the hills, in the swept and garnished chambers of an empty pyramid. Quentin Lambert Beecham, MS, PhD, FRAS, etc., had set up the series of temporary camps
in which he did the archaeological work that would make him famous long before a car crash ended his brother's life, and through me, into his. Not one to dither over petty details like an orphan niece, Uncle Lamb had promptly enrolled me in a boarding school. Not one to accept the vagaries of fate without a fight, I declined absolutely to go there. And, recognising something in me that he had himself in abundant measure, Uncle Lamb had shrugged, and on the decision of a heartbeat, had taken me forever from the world of order and routine, of sums, clean sheets, and daily baths, to follow him into vagabondage. The roving life had continued with Frank, though with a shift from field to universities, as the digging of a historian is usually conducted within walls. So when the war came in 1939, it was less a disruption to me than to most. I had moved from our latest hired flat into the junior nurses' quarters at Pembroke Hospital, and from there to a field station in France, and back again to Pembroke before war's end. And then those few brief months with Frank before we came to Scotland, seeking to find each other again. Only to lose each other once and for all, when I had walked into a stone circle, through madness, and out the other side, into the past that was my present. It was strange then, and rather wonderful, to wake in the upper bedroom at Lallybroch, next to Jamie, and realise, as I watched the dawn touch his sleeping face, that he had been born in this bed. All the sounds of the house, from the creak of the back stair under an early rising maid's foot, to the drumming rain on the roof slates, were sounds he had heard a thousand times before. Heard so often, he didn't hear them any more. I did. His mother, Ellen, had planted the late-blooming rosebush by the door. Its faint, rich scent still wafted up the walls of the house to the bedroom window. It was as though she reached in herself to touch him lightly in passing. To touch me, too, in welcome. Beyond the house itself lay Lallybroch. Fields and barns and village and crofts. He had fished in the stream that ran down from the hills, climbed the oaks and towering larches, eaten by the hearthstone of every croft. It was his place. But he too had lived with disruption and change, arrest and the flight of outlawry, the rootless life of a mercenary soldier, arrest again, imprisonment and torture, and the flight into exile so recently ended. But he had lived in one place for his first 14 years, and even at that age, when he had been sent, as was the custom, to foster for 2 years with his mother's brother, Dougal Mackenzie, it was part and parcel of the life expected for a man who would return to live forever on his land, to care for his tenants and estate, to be a part of a larger organism. Permanence was his destiny. But there had been that space of absence and the experience of things beyond the boundaries of Lallybroch, even beyond the rocky coasts of Scotland. Jamie had spoken with kings, had touched law and commerce, seen adventure and violence and magic. Once the boundaries of home had been transgressed, could destiny be enough to hold him? I wondered. As I came down from the crest of the hill, I saw him below, heaving boulders into place as he repaired a rift in a dry stone dike that bordered one of the smaller fields. Near him on the ground lay a pair of rabbits, neatly gutted but not yet skinned. "Home is the sailor, home from the sea, and the hunter home from the hill," I quoted, smiling at him as I came up beside him. He grinned back, wiped the sweat from his brow, then pretended to shudder. "Dinna mention the sea to me, Sassenach. I saw two wee laddies sailing a bit of wood in the millpond this morning and nearly heaved up my breakfast at the sight." I laughed. "You haven't any urge to go back to France, then?" "God, no. Not even for the brandy." He heaved one last stone to the top of the wall and settled it into place. "Going back to the house?" "Yes. Do you want me to take the rabbits?" He shook his head and bent to pick them up. "No need. I'm going back myself. Ian needs a hand with the new storage cellar for the potatoes."
The first potato crop ever planted on Lallybroch was due for harvest within a few days, and, on my timorous and inexpert advice, a small root cellar was being dug to house them. I had distinctly mixed feelings whenever I looked at the potato field. On the one hand, I felt considerable pride in the sprawling leafy vines that covered it. On the other, I felt complete panic at the thought that 60 families might depend on what lay under those vines for sustenance through the winter. It was on my advice, given hastily a year ago, that a prime barley field had been planted in potatoes, a crop hitherto unknown in the Highlands. I knew that in the fullness of time potatoes would become an important staple of life in the Highlands, less susceptible to blight and failure than the crops of oats and barley. Knowing that from a paragraph read in a geography book long ago was a far cry from deliberately taking responsibility for the lives of the people who would eat the crop. I wondered if the taking of risks for other people got easier with practice. Jamie did it routinely, managing the affairs of the estate and the tenants as though he'd been born to it. But of course, he had been born to it. "Is the cellar nearly ready?" I asked. "Oh, aye. Ian's got the doors built, and the pit's nearly dug. It's only there's a soft bit of earth near the back, and his peg gets stuck in when he stands there." While Ian managed very well on the wooden peg he wore in substitute for his lower right leg, there were the occasional awkwardnesses such as this. Jamie glanced thoughtfully up the hill behind us. "We'll need the cellar finished and covered by tonight. It's going to rain again before dawn." I turned to look in the direction of his gaze. Nothing showed on the slope but grass and heather, a few trees, and the rocky seams of granite that poked bony ridges through the scruffy undergrowth. "How in hell can you tell that?" He smiled, pointing uphill with his chin.
"See the small oak tree and the ash nearby."
I glanced at the trees, baffled.
"Yes? What about them?"
"The leaves, Sassenach. See how both trees look lighter than usual? When there's damp in the air, the leaves of an oak or an ash will turn, so you see the underside. The whole tree looks several shades lighter."
"I suppose it does,"
I agreed doubtfully, "if you happen to know what colour the tree is normally."
Jamie laughed and took my arm.
"I may not have an ear for music, Sassenach, but have eyes in my head. And I've seen those trees maybe 10,000 times in every weather there is."
It was some way from the field to the farmhouse, and we walked in silence for the most part, enjoying the brief warmth of the afternoon sun on our backs. I sniffed the air and thought that Jamie was probably right about the coming rain. All the normal autumn smells seemed intensified, from the sharp pine resins to the dusty smell of ripe grain. I thought that I must be learning myself, becoming attuned to the rhythms and sights and smells of Lallybroch. Maybe in time I would come to know it as well as Jamie did. I squeezed his arm briefly and felt the pressure of his hand on mine in response.
"Do you miss France, Sassenach?"
he said suddenly.
"No,"
I said, startled.
"Why?"
He shrugged, not looking at me.
"Well, it's only I was thinking, seeing you come down the hill with a basket on your arm, how bonny you looked with the sun on your brown hair. I thought you looked as though you grew there, like one of the saplings, like you'd always been a part of this place. And then it struck me that to you, Lallybroch's maybe a poor wee spot. There's no grand life like there was in France, not even interesting work as you had at the hôpital."
He glanced down at me shyly.
"I suppose I worry you'll grow bored wi' it here in time."
I paused before answering, though it wasn't something I hadn't thought about. "In time," I said carefully. "Jamie, I've seen a lot of things in my life and been in a lot of places. Where I came from, there were things there that I miss sometimes. I'd like to ride a London omnibus again,
or pick up a telephone and talk to someone far away. I'd like to turn a tap and have hot water, not carry it from the well and heat it in a cauldron. I'd like all that, but I don't need it. As for a grand life, I didn't want it when I had it. Nice clothes are all very well, but if gossip and scheming and worry and silly parties and tiny rules of etiquette go with them, no. I'd as soon live in my shift and say what I like. He laughed at that, and I squeezed his arm once more. As for the work, there's work for me here. I glanced down into the basket of herbs and medicines on my arm. I can be useful. And if I miss Mother Hildegard or my other friends, well, it isn't as fast as a telephone, but there are always letters. I stopped, holding his arm, and looked up at him. The sun was setting, and the light gilded one side of his face, throwing the strong bones into relief. Jamie, I only want to be where you are. Nothing else. He stood still for a moment, then leaned forward and kissed me very gently on the forehead. It's funny, I said, as we came over the crest of the last small hill that led down to the house. I'd just been wondering the same kinds of things about you. Whether you'd be happy here after the things you did in France. He smiled half ruefully and looked toward the house, its three stories of white harled stone glowing gold and umber in the sunset.
Well, it's Hohmsassenach. It's my place.
I touched him gently on the arm. And you were born to it, you mean? He drew a deep breath and reached out to rest a hand on the wooden fence rail that separated this lower field from the grounds near the house.
Well, in fact, I wasn't born to it, Sassenach. By rights, it should have been Willy was lairdy here. Had he lived, I expect I would have been a soldier, or maybe a merchant, like Jared.
Willy, Jamie's elder brother, had died of the smallpox at the age of 11, leaving his small brother, aged 6, as the heir to Lallybroch. He made an odd half-shrugging gesture, as though seeking to ease the pressure of his shirt across his shoulders. It was something he did when feeling awkward or unsure. I hadn't seen him do it in months.
But Willy died, and so I am laird.
He glanced at me, a little shyly, then reached into his sporran and pulled something out. A little cherrywood snake that Willie had carved for him as a birthday gift lay on his palm, head twisted, as though surprised to see the tail following it. Jamie stroked the little snake gently. The wood was shiny and seasoned with handling, the curves of the body gleaming like scales in early twilight.
I talk to Willie sometimes in my mind, Jamie said.
He tilted the snake on his palm.
If you'd lived, brother, if ye'd been laird as you were meant to be, would you do what I've done, or would you find a better way?
He glanced down at me, flushing slightly.
Does that sound daft?
No. I touched the snake's smooth head with a fingertip. The high, clear call of a meadowlark came from the far field, thin as crystal in the evening air. I do the same, I said softly, after a moment, with Uncle Lamb, and my parents. My mother, especially. I didn't think of her often when I was young. Just every now and then I'd dream about someone soft and warm with a lovely singing voice. But when I was sick, after Faith, sometimes I imagined she was there, with me. A sudden wave of grief swept over me, remembrance of losses recent and long past. Jamie touched my face gently, wiping away the tear that had formed at the corner of one eye, but not quite fallen.
I think sometimes the dead cherish us as we do them, he said softly.
He linked my arm in his, tight against his side, and we turned along the fence, walking slowly, the dry grass rustling against my skirt.
"I ken what you mean, Sassenach," Jamie said. "I hear my father's voice sometimes, in the barn or in the field. When I'm not even thinking of him, usually. But all at once, I'll turn my head as though I'd just heard him outside, laughing with one of the tenants, or behind me, gentling a horse."
He laughed suddenly, and nodded toward a corner of the pasture before us.
"It's a wonder I didna hear him here, but I never have."
It was a thoroughly unremarkable spot, a wood-railed gate in the stone fence that paralleled the road.
"Really? What did he used to say here?"
"Usually it was, 'If you're through talking, Jamie, turn about and bend over.'"
We laughed, pausing to lean on the fence. I bent closer, squinting at the wood.
"So this is where you got smacked. I don't see any tooth marks," I said.
"No, it wasn't all that bad," he said, laughing.
He ran a hand affectionately along the worn ash fence rail.
"We used to get splinters in our fingers sometimes, Ian and me. We'd go up to the house after, and Mrs. Crook or Jenny would pick them out for us, scolding all the time."
He glanced toward the manor, where all the first-floor windows glowed with light against the gathering night. Dark forms moved briefly past the windows, small, quick-moving shadows in the kitchen windows, where Mrs. Crook and the maids were at the dinner preparations. A larger form, tall and slender as a fence-rail, loomed suddenly in one of the drawing-room windows. Ian stood a moment, silhouetted in the light as though called by Jamie's reminiscence. Then he drew the curtains, and the window dulled to a softer, shrouded glow.
"I was always glad when Ian was with me," Jamie said, still looking toward the house. "When we got caught at some devilry and got thrashed for it, I mean."
"Misery loves company," I said, smiling.
"A bit. I didn't feel quite so wicked when there were the two of us to share the guilt between. But it was more that I could always count on him to make a lot of noise."
"What? To cry out, you mean?"
"Aye. He'd always howl and carry on something awful, and I knew he would do it so I didn't feel so ashamed of my own noise if I had to cry out."
It was too dark to see his face any more, but I could still see the half-shrugging gesture he made when embarrassed or uncomfortable.
"I always tried not to, of course, but I couldn't always manage. If my da thought it worth thrashing me over, he thought it worth doing a proper job. And Ian's father had a right arm like a tree bole."
"You know," I said, glancing down at the house, "I never thought of it particularly before, but why on earth did your father thrash you out here, Jamie? Surely there's enough room in the house, or the barn?" Jamie was silent for a moment, then shrugged again.
"I didn't ever ask. But I reckon it was something like the King of France."
"The King of France?" This apparent non-sequitur took me aback a bit.
"Aye. I dinna ken," he said dryly, "quite what it's like to have to wash and dress and move your bowels in public. But I can tell you that it's a very humbling experience to have to stand there and explain to one of your father's tenants just what you did that's about to get your ass scalded for you."
"I imagine it must be," I said, sympathy mingled with the urge to laugh.
"Because you were going to be laird, you mean? That's why he made you do it here?"
"I expect so. The tenants would know I understood justice, at least from the receiving end."
Chapter 32 Field of Dreams. The field had been ploughed in the usual rigs, high ridges of piled earth, with deep furrows drawn between them. The rigs rose knee-high, so a man walking down the furrows could sow his seed easily by hand along the top of the rig beside him.
designed for the planting of barley or oats, no reason had been seen to alter them for the planting of potatoes.
"It said hills," Ian said, peering over the leafy expanse of the potato field, "but I thought the rigs would do as well. The point of the hills seemed to be to keep the things from rotting with too much water, and an old field with high rigs seemed like to do that as well."
"That seems sensible," Jamie agreed. "The top parts seem to be flourishing anyway. Does the man say how you ken when to dig the things up, though?"
Charged with the planting of potatoes in a land where no potato had ever been seen, Ian had proceeded with method and logic, sending to Edinburgh both for seed potatoes and for a book on the subject of planting. In due course, a scientific treatise on methods of farming by Sir Walter O'Banion Riley had made its appearance, with a small section on potato planting, as presently practised in Ireland. Ian was carrying this substantial volume under one arm. Jenny had told me that he wouldn't go near the potato field without it, lest some knotty question of philosophy or technique occur to him while there, and now flipped it open, bracing it on one forearm as he groped in his sporran for the spectacles he wore when reading. These had belonged to his late father, small circles of glass set in wire rims, and customarily worn on the end of his nose, they made him look like a very earnest young stork.
"Harvesting of the crop should be undertaken simultaneously with the appearance of the first winter goose," he read,
then looked up, squinting accusingly over his spectacles at the potato field, as though expecting an indicative goose to stick its head up among the furrowed rigs.
"Winter goose?"
Jamie peered, frowning, at the book over Ian's shoulder.
"What sort of goose does he mean? Grey legs? But you see those all year. That canna be right."
Ian shrugged.
"Maybe you only see them in the winter in Ireland. Or maybe it's some kind of Irish goose he means, and not grey legs at all."
Jamie snorted.
"Well, the fat lot of good that does us. Does he see anything useful?"
Ian ran a finger down the lines of type, moving his lips silently. We had by now collected a small crowd of cotters, all fascinated by this novel approach to agriculture.
"You dinna dig potatoes when it's wet," Ian informed us, eliciting a louder snort from Jamie.
"Hmm," Ian murmured to himself. "Potato rot, potato bugs. We didna hae any potato bugs. I suppose that's lucky. Potato vines. Ah, no. That's only what to do if the vines wilt. Potato blight. We canna tell if we have that until we see the potatoes. Seed potatoes, potato storage."
Impatient, Jamie turned away from Ian, hands on his hips.
"Scientific farming, eh?" he demanded.
He glared at the field of dark green leafy vines.
"I suppose it's too damn scientific to explain how you tell when the bloody things are ready to eat."
Fergus, who had been tagging along behind Jamie as usual, looked up from a caterpillar, inching its slow and fuzzy way along his forefinger.
"Why don't you just dig one up and see?" he asked.
Jamie stared at Fergus for a moment. His mouth opened, but no sound emerged. He shut it, patted Fergus gently on the head, and went to fetch a pitchfork from its place against the fence. The cotters, all men who had helped to plant and tend the field under Ian's direction, assisted by Sir Walter, clustered round to see the results of their labour. Jamie chose a large and flourishing vine near the edge of the field and poised the fork carefully near its roots. Visibly holding his breath, he put a foot on the heel of the fork and pushed. The tines slid slowly into the damp brown dirt. I was holding my own breath. There was a good deal more depending on this experiment than the reputation of Sir Walter O'Banion Riley. Or my own, for that matter. Jamie and Ian had confirmed that the barley crop this year was smaller than normal, though still sufficient for the needs of the Lallybroch tenants. Another bad year would exhaust the meagre reserves of grain, though. For a Highland estate, Lallybroch was prosperous. but that was saying something only by comparison with other Highland farms. Successful potato planting could well make the difference between hunger and plenty for the folk of Lallybroch over the next 2 years. Jamie's heel pressed down and he leaned back on the handle of the fork. The earth crumbled and cracked around the